right, we are live now. And I have a buzz on the speaker. Where's it coming from, Dan? That took some of it out. I see all of you here tonight. I'm going to continue with G. Campbell Morgan. I haven't given you much time to call. Again, I say, one of the inspiring things about the Jesus Save signs that tower over the cathedral is the reminder of those who have preached under it over the years, some of the greatest preachers ever to grace a pulpit. And I try to remember that heritage each time I go there, in the knowledge that God made us the ones who could lift those signs over the city again. And certainly one of the greatest was G. Campbell Morgan, a mentor of my own spiritual foundations over the years, and I've said probably 80% of the evangelical pastors in the world have some one of the many reprints of the Westminster Pulpit, which is a transcription of his preaching raw, with very little editing. It became the inspiration for the University Cathedral Pulpit, with the hope that in even some small way, in the years ahead, the teachings at the cathedral could provide, even in a small bit, the kind of inspiration and guidance and faith building and understanding that Morgan's preaching has done, certainly to me. So I'm going to continue with it tonight, as I have for some weeks. I said the only difference between me and this 80% of other preachers is that I read his message and say it's his. They preach it and say it's theirs. And I never fail to point out he stubbed out his cigar in a flower pot on the way to the pulpit to preach under those Jesus Save signs that you see so often here on the screen. And with that, I want to know if his message has driven you away or if you're still there. So get on the telephone and let me know you're there before I begin the teaching. The Preaching of G. Campbell Morgan, the Westminster Pulpit, Volume 9, Second Message. Simple title, Ambitions. Desire, 1 Corinthians 12, verse 31. Desire earnestly the greater gifts. We're all familiar with the word ambition. It comes to us from the Latin. It has acquired a significance quite other than that of its first meaning. Ambition. What was its first meaning in the Latin? Quite literally, it simply means going round. In process of time, it came to signify going round for votes. Today it stands for that mood of the soul which makes a man go round for something he desires. Today it stands for earnest desire, especially desire for honor in some form. Thus it will be seen that the word originally described a method, an action, while today it's used rather of a purpose, an inspiration. See the difference? Originally going round, an action. Now it's come to mean purpose or inspiration. Let us take some time to consider the subject of ambition as to its place, its peril, and its power in human life. This we shall do in light of the text selected. Now, I recognize there are four larger values in this text than I intend to deal with. There is, however, exactly the light we need if we're to finally understand the proper place and power of ambition in human life. In considering this, therefore, we will first of all dwell with some technical care upon the word of which the apostle made use, and which the revisers have translated desire earnestly. And which has come to be connected to the word in the Latin ambition. But Paul wrote in Greek. The King James translates covet. Covet earnestly the greater gifts. It's one word in the Greek, two words in English. If you listen closely, you'll quickly connect the cognate word in the English for the Greek word being translated with two words here, covet earnestly. The Greek word zelute. Zelute. We get two words in the English language from it. And I refer to the words zealous and jealous. Both come from zelute. Zealous is a word full of suggestiveness, its root idea being that of fire, of passion. Zeal is the driving force in endeavor. Jealousy is that which guards the way. Thus, in our two words, we have two aspects of the same central thought. The activity suggested by the word is that of mental approbation, which expresses itself in strenuous endeavor. The idea is expressed exactly by our modern use of the word ambition. It is a strong desire, zeal being the driving force, zealous, jealousy being that which guards what the driving force has obtained. The strong desire to obtain position, power, honor, in the best sense of that word, honor. Now, it is a prevalent notion that ambition is wholly evil. Remember, Wolsey said to Cromwell, "Cromwell, I charge thee, fling away ambition. By that sin fell the angels. How could man then, the image of his Maker, hope to win by it?" Or again, Mark Antony, "The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it were so, it was a grievous fault, and grievously hath Caesar answered it." Here, under leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honorable man, so are they all honorable men, come I to speak in Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful, and just to me. But Brutus says he was ambitious. Brutus was an honorable man. In each of the quotations, the conception is that ambition is evil. This is not necessarily so. The fundamental principle of society is that of individual self-preservation and self-realization. There's no perfected society that's not made up of perfected individuals. A chain's as strong as its weakest link, a castle as strong as its least guarded door. If in society there are links that are weak, society's weak. If in the great household of men there are individuals that are imperfect, then the household of men remains imperfect. Perfect units are needed for perfect unity. Therefore, every individual must aim at high things, noble things, and desire honor. This is ambition in its simplest, purest form. This is not necessarily evil. There is one brief prophecy in the book of Jeremiah, a simple prophecy among the great utterances of the prophet of thunder and tears, a prophecy uttered to one man, to Baruch, the man associated with Jeremiah, his faithful helper in his work. And the heart of the prophecy to Baruch is contained in these words. Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. Jeremiah did not tell Baruch that he was not to seek great things. He told him he was not to seek great things for himself. There in a flash we have the revelation of the difference between true and false, good and evil ambition. That reveals the peril of ambition. When a man seeks great things for himself, or any person, seeks great things for himself, what cares he how many suffer so that he succeeds? How many are downtrodden so that he may rise? How many are flung out by the whirling wheel so long as the ambitious one for himself arrive at the goal? Such ambition is the spawn of hell, the progeny of Lucifer, who fell from his high estate by ambition that was entirely self-centered. If any man will come after me, skipping all the others and hate not himself, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever forsaketh not all that he hath cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross cannot be my disciple. And come after me. When a man seeks great things not for himself, but in the interest of God and his calling and will, then ambition is godly, sacred, pure, the inspiration of all that is noble. There has never been a self-centered person enshrined in the memory of the history of any group. It was Jesus who said, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but thine. From 12 years old to his parents who claimed him, wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business? To the resistance against the temptation of Satan and the pressure of those around him to back off from the cross, for this cause I came. to the prayer of agony in the garden. I came to do the will of the Father that sent me. To desire honor for oneself without reference. To be ambitious for oneself without reference. To be zealous and jealous of oneself without reference to its effect upon others is wholly evil. Along that line, all despots have climbed to the thrones from which they have crushed and cursed humanity. But to desire honor for oneself in order that the honor gained may be made an occasion of help and blessing and healing. A furtherance of God's work in His way is the very way by which, I say it reverently, but I say it, our Lord and Master has climbed to the throne of universal empire and will at last heal all wounds, end all weariness, wipe away all tears, and lead the race into the wonder of the kingdom of heaven and God. Therefore, true ambition is a great and gracious power. To desire, to covet in that sense, is necessarily to strive. Thus, it becomes the secret power which contributes to the realization of that which is the statement of the Lord's Prayer. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. You want me to continue? Go on telephone. I've been asking you to pray for Christine's mother. She has a very serious heart condition that requires open heart surgery, but has other serious conditions in her body, an infection that was necessary to be cured before the surgery could take place, healing from the consequences of severe diabetic condition that, as you know, affects the kidneys, an overall healing in her body in order to be able to let the surgeons do the work on her heart. Please keep praying for Christine's mother. Tony Oshie has just come out of another battery of chemotherapy. Considering his condition, he's doing remarkably well. That'll continue only as you intercede and prevail in prayer. Don't stop praying for Tony Rodriguez, or rather Tony Oshie, our electrician and chief engineer for a long time, and we're missing him in many areas. Christine's mother, Mr. Lod Cook, we went to dinner with him a couple of weeks ago. He's back in the office a few days of the week. Asked me to thank all of you for your prayers and the encouragement that the messages I delivered to him from you during his recuperative period. Prayer does matter. Now get on the telephone for one more song, please. I've been reading from P. Campbell Morgan's messages and writings. I think this is how I'm going to read from Gene Scott. How many of you have read this little book, Hole in Rome? No, about half of you here. How many have read it this year? Five. How many have read it more than once? Well, about all of you. How many haven't ever read it? About the same amount. Hold them up again. How many have read this book? Well, you're going to hear it read. I used to go every Christmas time to Rome. Up a ways from the Colosseum, you come to the central portion of Rome's great historic ruins. And if you stand on the street that looks down across the Roman Forum, look immediately to the right, there's the remains of Hadrian's Arch, with all the carvings of the trophies of great Roman victories. Further distant to the right are the ruins of Circus Maximus, where more Christians were put to death to the amusement of Caesar and the throngs than was the case even in the Colosseum. You look immediately in front of you, as I said, across the old Roman Forum, and then to the left, the remains of the old Roman Senate building. And hidden rather innocuously in a little building that's built over the top of an old hewn out solid rock cistern that now has a stairwell that goes down into that hewn out cistern. Oh, I'd say maybe 15 feet high and 10 to 15 feet wide and sort of hewn out like an egg with a simple little rock pedestal sitting in the corner with another rock on it as though someone used it to write on. It was a cistern. Now they have this innocuous building built above it that sells souvenirs. But that, in Paul's day, was the Mamertine dungeon. There was no stairwell. They opened a trapdoor iron gate at the top and dropped the prisoner in. I had gone every year at Christmas time and would renew my spirit for the coming year after a year of labor. Those days I traveled all across the world and teaching missions and helping schools transfer leadership from missionaries to nationals, but I always made it to Rome at Christmas time. I'd come often enough. I knew the ones who took care of this shrine, and the universal language of money would buy me a private time down in the dungeon. I haven't been there for 18 years, a little over. I'm going this June. If I have to do services by telephone, I'm going to Rome this June. Can't wait till Christmas. But I went there to take a fix and re-examine my own ministry. In the hurly-burly of the travel and the testings and the pouring out to others, I rather frequently worried that in preaching to others, like Paul, I might be a castaway. One year, several years ago, Campbell Morgan's sermons were in 1906 to 1916. This was 1971. 4 years before God, against my will, God, I remember it being against my will. In October. Whatever. What's anniversary Sunday? October or November? First Sunday of November, 1975. I began my ministry here. I still remember an afternoon in February, 5 months later, by myself, behind the then parsonage in which my parents lived. Eventually, it had been Willard Cantlin's home, was bought by the church. I was staying in it before my parents came down to be associates. I was alone. It had taken me those 5 months on that Sunday afternoon when I finally said yes to God and in my heart gave up and accepted that God had me here at this devastation church at the time with all the problems on every side. And the yen was still there to get on the plane, and the tug was still there. Particularly, I've mentioned it many times, one national church leader in Brazil who had begged me to return. I didn't want this job. But in that February Sunday afternoon, I said, yes, I will be done. I haven't gone to Rome since. If I hadn't do that by going back to this prison cell, when I would get ambitious. And I, this year, went back again and again. Stayed about a week. Stayed up in the old Hilton Hotel that I don't like as well as the Excelsior and some of the more downtown hotels to stay in. But I stayed there that time because it sits on a hilltop and you can look out all over Rome and see the towering church steeples and the power of God through the centuries revealed in those churches all across. That great city of Rome. I went back again and again and wrote this little book while I was there. You know, I haven't read it in a long time. A Hole in Rome, Leaves from the Notebook of a Tamed Rebel. Rome, Italy, January 2nd. I'd gone past Christmas. It was toward the end of the week. The tears were warm on my face after the biting cold outside, and it's very cold in Rome about that time. So the tears were warm on my face after the biting cold outside. In the chill of the rock-hewn cistern, they dropped off my chin as I stood quietly. And by the way, I'd gone many times, but there was a particular thing that I was going through. A crisis, as I preached Sunday, of the kind I thought every time I go through one is the last one, that had driven me to Rome this time. So I had a little more emotions playing in my system. In the chill of the rock-hewn cistern, they dropped off my chin as I stood quietly, alone and crying, 20 feet underground. I guess it was about 20 feet. The place was Mamertine Dungeon, Paul's prison at Rome. And I stood there a long time. Tourists came and went. Each time I turned to face the wall to avoid displaying my emotions. I don't know all the reasons for my tears. No single explanation's enough. Many feelings were surfacing at the impact of this place. I'd left San Francisco jetting across the pole, first to Paris, 20 hours later in Rome. It was a personal, spiritual pilgrimage. It followed a year of struggle and conflict in a world which relentlessly pulls the eye of faith off from its course. Like a mariner buffeted by the wind, I was rechecking directions, and like a compass needle to its magnet, I was drawn again to this spot. The power of its message gripped me as I stood in the dim light. I came this trip with deeper understanding of Paul as a person. I'll go this time also. I had preached verse by verse through both Romans and 1 Corinthians, preparing recorded tape studies. As you well know, since then, through Hebrews, Ephesians, Galatians, I had felt his human hopes for a prosperous and joyful journey to Rome. That's what he intended to have happen. A prosperous and joyful journey to Rome. That's what he had written other Christians saying he was going to do. Today I stood and viewed the reality of his journey's end. It consisted of cold stone walls less than 10 feet high, not 20 feet across, and under the ground. The seen world would appear to pass him by. His life seemed purposeless, meaningless, ending in dark failure. If you ever come to this place, please do what I did. Take a New Testament and read the letter he wrote from this very place, known as 2 Timothy. Questions I'd asked myself many times crowded into my mind. Still does all the time. Question number one. How can I know that I'm in God's will? More particularly, how can I be sure that I'm in God's will when circumstances are, one, contrary to past hopes, two, against the expectancies of others, and three, irrevocably different from anticipated plans, which was my case in 1971. Paul faced this exact problem at the Mamertine prison. His past hopes were clear, and a letter written from Corinth, carried to Rome by a business lady Christian. He had hoped for a prosperous journey to Rome with joyful temporary fellowship with the Christians there, and then to continue on to preach the gospel in Spain. You read those expectancies in the letter carried from Corinth to Rome in Romans 1:10 and 15:24. Against those hopes, he arrived in chains and was locked in a prison. Against the expectancies of others, Paul faced that when he proceeded to Jerusalem in Acts 21. There, they laid hands on him, the Christians, and prophesied he'd be bound to Jerusalem en route. He said, "What mean you to weep and break mine heart? Know you not that I'm ready to be bound on, not only to be bound, but to die?" He was bound, but he didn't die. And instead of his joyful and prosperous journey, he arrived in chains and now in prison. He's still having to defend his path against the expectancies of others. Everybody knows God's will for us, except ourselves. He pleads for other Christians not to be ashamed of his state in his letter to Timothy, pleading against the judgment of other Christians that they not be ashamed of his condition. His great plans to go by Rome and have fellowship and then preach the gospel in Spain, his plans seem completely thwarted. This I've faced again and again, just when you're about to break out, your plans get thwarted. So was the case for Paul in that dark, hewn-out cistern. Above his prison, it was business as usual. And Paul's voice was buried, seemingly unheard, 20 feet underground. Life was passing him by. The Roman Senate met less than 50 yards away, carving out its decisions of power. The bank was also less than 50 yards away, storing up the flow of this world's wealth. The Roman Forum stretched hundreds of yards away to the base of the hill on which Caesar's palace stood. And the palace could provide sensual pleasure unlimited. Hugh Hefner could have gone to school there. Looking beyond it, to the left was the Colosseum and to the right Maximus Circus. These last two, for the pleasure of the populace, gave constant testimony to the apparent futility of the Christian faith as believers became victims on display in the arenas. Paul's plan to bring the power of God to Rome, which is what he said he was going to do in that letter sent from Corinth, and his witness of the gospel, seemed painfully dim as one views the walls of his constrictive prison. Paul had every human right to say, "Is this really the will of God for me? Cut off from witnessing, isolated from opportunity. What did I do to cause this to happen to me?" If such questions were in Paul's mind, they didn't show up in his letter to Timothy. Instead, imagine this. Query: am I in God's will in this prison? Answer: Paul, this is his letter from there to Timothy, Paul, an apostle, which means one sent by the will of God in this prison. Query: how can I, in such contrary circumstances, know that I'm in God's will? Answer: I know in whom I have believed. I am persuaded that He is able to keep that which I have committed unto Him against that day. Paul's confidence was in the person of God to whom he had committed himself. The nature of that person, God, remained unchanged in all circumstance. For many years I've been saying that people worry too much about how to find God's will. God is, we just don't like where He places us. They're not really worrying about how to find God's will. They're worried that they can't convince God to approve their will. God is not a sadist who plays hide and seek with His servants. The message of the Bible is that we were lost and God found us. When He hath found us, He layeth us on His shoulder rejoicing, "I have found my sheep, which was lost." My sheep. Not these sheep. My sheep. There never been a sheep that doesn't want to wander. Once having found us, God does not then seek to hide from us. The Bible promises the steps of a good man are ordered to the Lord. Thus, and here's the key. Only I know about me. Only you know about you. If a man or woman honestly wants, God's will for their life, commits their life to God in trust and acknowledges Him in all their ways, then that man, that person, will find it harder to get out of God's will than to stay in it. When you believe that, I'm having a hard time right now. The urge will never leave any of us. Today, can I catch God on His soft side and have Him approve my will? If a man honestly wants God's will for his life, tough one. When I was elected here, I didn't want. Abstractly, I wanted God's will for my life. But He had, I thought, didn't ever really put it in words, but He had taken some divine stupid pill and sent me to Faith Center. And I didn't want His will. I wanted to persuade Him that was not His will for me. Now, if you want me to continue, get on telephone. I'm reading.